Once again, we say greetings to each and every one of you. Akwaba, welcome. Welcome to another round of Culturally Conscious Communications here on the LIV Radio Network. My name is Kitty Obi Awadu, a.k.a. the Conscious Rasta. This is where you and I get together weekday mornings. We come at you live from 7 a.m. on the West Coast. That's 10 a.m. for our East Coast listeners. And that's 3 p.m. GMT, Accra time. We get together with you live to deal with culture, consciousness, historical perspective. We deal with entertainment, economics, education, health, labor, law, politics, religion, family, conflict, all areas of human interactivity and human development. Today's date is Thursday, the 24th of April, the year 2008 in the Roman Western calendar. This corresponds to the year 6248 according to the most ancient calendar of ancient Egypt, of Kemet, to which we have realigned our cultural clock. Welcome to the seventh millennium. You have found your family in a peaceful place here on LIB Radio, LIB TV, and simulcasting our video stream on livinginblack.com, our brand new global social organizing network for people of African descent. Do you have been a listener to LIB Radio over the years, you will realize that LIB Radio has been, I think, the single greatest outlet for radio broadcasts, airing of documentaries on the subject of challenging, fundamentally, the science, or so-called science, pseudoscience, that has brought the world this so-called HIV/AIDS epidemic. We have challenged it to its very core. We've had some of the strongest voices in the world who are of the dissenting sector of questioning whether what has been said about this pandemic, HIV/AIDS, and I don't even like putting the two words next to each other, or two acronyms next to each other. We've challenged it. Today we're going to continue that dialogue, because yesterday, April 23rd, was the 24th anniversary of the foisting upon the world of this hypothesis that HIV was the cause of AIDS. A hypothesis never really been validated. Our guest today is one of the fundamental leaders of the movement to rethink AIDS. Let us welcome from Rethinking AIDS our guest today. Joining us out of, I believe, Alberta, Canada, we have David Crowe. Welcome to the program today, David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderfully, Katie, and thanks for having me on your show. And really, thank you for continuing to address this issue that in the mainstream media is still being actively censored.
Yes, yes. The mainstream media right now in the United States, almost said something even worse, in the United States is engaged in wholesale trivia elevation. And when it comes to issues of health, they are covering up for their buddies, their cousins, their cartel buddies in the whole areas of medical sickness maintenance, as well as pharmaceutical drugs, the whole medical industrial complex. But when it comes to this one single subject of AIDS, some are saying that this is the greatest medical scam of all time. Let me have your perspective on those who would say that HIV as the cause of AIDS is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, medical scam of all time.
Yeah, well, it started in a very questionable way by a press conference prior to any of the science being published. What was just as interesting is the fact that the announcement by Robert Gallo and Margaret Heckler, she ran, I think, Health and Human Services in those days. You know, the announcement of at a press conference that they had discovered the probable cause of AIDS did occur after one very important thing, and that was the patenting of a blood test. That indicates that money was as important as everything else, because, of course, if they had announced it and then tried to patent it, they wouldn't have been able to. So clearly they were thinking, how are we going to make money off this, especially Robert Gallo. What was really interesting also about the patenting was that this was not the first application the patent office had had for an HIV blood test. They had already received one months earlier from Pasteur Institute of France, but it was so important for the U.S. medical establishment to claim that they had discovered the cause of AIDS that they had to even somehow manipulate the U.S. Patent Office into approving a fraudulent patent, which resulted in years of negotiation between the U.S. and French governments to try to create a false history of what actually happened. But, of course, none of that is too important if they hadn't actually discovered it.
Okay. David, unfortunately, we're getting a bad breakup on your telephone. Are you using a cell phone or a wireless?
No, I have an external microphone here. Is that...
Yeah, whatever is happening, we're getting a fragmentary conversation from you that we won't be able to continue.
Is this better?
That is immensely better. Thank you so much.
Oh, okay. I'm really sorry. Did you hear what I
heard that, let's talk once again about the fraudulent patenting. You had said that once before they had a patent, and that was where the phone began breaking up.
Yeah, well, the U.S. Patent Office had received an application from the Pasteur Institute in France, which had languished without much attention at the Patent Office, but when they got Gallo's patent, it was rushed through in record time. So if that doesn't mean there was government interference in the whole patenting process, I don't know what it could possibly mean. But from a scientific perspective, the most important thing was that Gallo had not published his research. So he was announcing a conclusion when no other scientists had the opportunity to review it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did review it, like I have one of his four papers that were published in May 1984, that's several weeks later. A couple of weeks later, you'll find that adult AIDS with opportunistic infections, he claimed to have isolated HIV from 47.6% of people with AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
So he's finding the supposed virus in less than half of the people. And yet, somehow, because this had been announced at a press conference with the full force of the U.S. government medical establishment behind him, it had already been accepted as fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he actually published the shoddy research, possibly worse than shoddy, he didn't even claim to have found the virus in more than half the people. And even worse than that, a couple of years later, he was forced to admit that what he called a transmission electron micrograph, which he claimed contained pictures of the virus, he had to admit that actually he'd taken those pictures from samples from the Pasteur Institute, so they weren't even his. So the whole thing was a fraud. But then the question is, well, did Montagné ever isolate the virus? And Montagné was caught on tape a few years ago, not caught on tape,
mm-hmm.
He was asked a direct question, and he agreed, we never purified the virus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what a lot of this comes down to. What were they looking at in 1984? Was it actually a virus, or were they so fixated on blaming a virus as opposed to blaming drug abuse, blaming exposure to blood products, that all they could think of was a virus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now we have 24 years after the fiasco of Margaret J. Heckler and Margaret Heckler and Robert Gallo's press conference. We have a perception of the most bizarre disease epidemic that ever could be imagined, caused by a pathogen that cannot be found in the overwhelming majority of people, a pathogen whose behavior apparently changes based upon your gender, your sexual orientation, your country of nationality, based upon your ethnicity or racial phenotype, based upon a bunch of criteria, whether you like to make love on your belly or love on your back. David, does all this make sense?
No. Well, I mean, Africa is really interesting because persistently in North America, the diagnoses of AIDS, and I don't want to call them anything more than that. I don't want to say it's really AIDS. The diagnoses of AIDS in North America have consistently been higher, significantly higher in men than in women. So obviously,
mm-hmm.
in North America, the virus is prejudiced against men.
Now, are we talking about the diagnosis of AIDS or the diagnosis of HIV-positive-related AIDS?
Well,
and there may be a difference, a distinction there.
the diagnosis of AIDS, it's a good point because mm-hmm. they don't really keep as accurate statistics of HIV, HIV tests, because so far they haven't been able to make HIV a reportable diagnosis in every state.
Mm-hmm.
And so the statistics on HIV are actually not very accurate at all.
Okay.
But in Africa, at least there, we have more information on HIV tests. Here, you have far more women than men testing positive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the African epidemic is driven by sex, there should be more men than women who are positive, because in Africa,
right.
like everywhere else,
mm-hmm.
it's the men who are more promiscuous than the women. But where is the evidence that Africans are more promiscuous than whites? Well, I think the evidence is probably the opposite.
The evidence for the number of sexual contacts per woman, the evidence for age of first sexual engagement for women, would all indicate that women in the Western countries, if this were a true STD, would be more vulnerable to HIV
right.
infection than would African women. Is that statement I made correct?
That's my understanding. But, of course, the idea that Africans are sexually promiscuous buys into this belief that has been nurtured amongst the whites back to the slave era, that blacks are sexually irresponsible. I mean, that's been a myth that has been promulgated for centuries.
Correct. And it feeds into the whole myth that Africans were subhuman and animal species and therefore couldn't control their quote-unquote animal lust.
Right. But it does cause a little bit of a problem, because it's always been the black man who's being blamed as the most sexually irresponsible. A black man making love to a white woman was one of the greatest crimes in America for years,
mm-hmm.
or treated as one of the greatest crimes. And yet here, like in South Africa in a recent survey, black women were something like 3 or 4 times more likely to be HIV positive than young black men.
Why do you think that these statistical anomalies for the disproportionate diagnosis of African women, not only in on the mother continent, but also in this country now, we have a disproportionate representation of black women. Why do you think this is occurring, David?
Well, that's an excellent question. If you believe that the antibody tests can find a virus, then it's very difficult to explain, if not impossible. But if the tests are indicating something else, and we're not looking for that something else, well, maybe there's solutions. One thing I've been interested in has been the use of cosmetics, especially skin lighteners. The active ingredient in skin lighteners is a benzene derivative, which is extremely toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, whites don't use skin lighteners. It's a cosmetic
mm-hmm.
that's only used by black people and mostly by women.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be stimulating the immune system, because benzene is toxic to the immune system, could it be stimulating the immune system and raising the risk of positive HIV tests in black women?
There was a Kenyan doctor and his wife who loudly protested after they became HIV antibody diagnosed in Kenya. Well, they said that their lifestyle had them wholly and completely outside of the risk categories. They blamed it on the use of nitrate-based antibiotics that they had been taking for some sort of malady that caused their bodies to become reactive on these antibody tests.
Well, that's also quite possible. It doesn't quite as well explain the gender difference in some countries like South Africa, although...
Mm-hmm.
There is indication that women are more likely to take medical injections than men. So, you know, it's possible that injection antibiotics could be one of the explanations.
Mm-hmm.
There's many possible explanations. One of the most exploited facets of science is if you don't look for something, you'll never find it.
Well, so, just to complement that, if I could just complete that statement, is that I know it to be fact that the surveillance methodology of choice on the African continent is what they call point of access to medical care for the HIV antibody testing process.
Well, that's been true a lot in the past. In the survey I'm citing, which is by Pettifor and other researchers, it was actually a much better survey. It was a random survey of young South Africans that was based on the number of people in each census district. So it avoided that bias of testing women at antenatal clinics.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say that based on that, the patterns of HIV positivity are probably close to the truth. The question is, what does a positive HIV test mean?
Or close to what would be expected to be true if this were truly an STD demonstrating itself within the population?
I don't think it reflects the sexual transmitted epidemic at all. I think it's probably an accurate reflection of the number of people in South Africa who are HIV positive. The question we have to ask is, what does a positive HIV test mean? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't necessarily mean that you're infected with a virus, then you'd say, well, we should be looking for some other factors that could explain this. The use of antibiotics, the use of perhaps injection birth control, skin lighteners. There may be a number of hypotheses we could come up with, but the great thing about science is if you don't look for evidence for any of those hypotheses, you're in no danger of ever finding any contrary evidence to your favorite theory.
Mm-hmm.
And this is unfortunately a common occurrence in science. If you want to believe a theory is true, you only look for evidence that can support the theory. You never look for evidence that might discredit the theory.
And what about scientists, a whole class of scientists who bring almost a broad spectrum of research that contradicts that fundamental hypothesis? And when we look at HIV, AIDS, pandemic, and the establishment that has been brought us, that has brought us this, isn't it true that a broad sector of scientists researching this have been excluded from having their research findings taken seriously?
Just within this past year, I know of four scientists whose jobs have been directly threatened because they have spoken out against the HIV-AIDS theory. That is, people have contacted the management of their institutions and specifically asked for those scientists to be sanctioned, and in all four cases, some kind of a sanction was brought against those scientists. So you have almost like a Stalinist style of system where there's sort of this group pressure. If you stick your neck out, you get slapped back down again. I mean, luckily people aren't being sent to the gulag, but for a scientist, if your funding gets cut off, if your ability to publish gets cut off, it's the scientific gulag for you. I mean, Duisberg is a classic example. 1987, he published a critical paper. He has not since then got a penny in U.S. government research funding. And, of course, the vast majority of research funding in the U.S. comes through the U.S. government. So he's essentially cut off. He's had extraordinary difficulty getting anything published. Even, the proceedings of the National Academy of Science, where he's guaranteed the ability to publish, they've strongly resisted him publishing articles on HIV and AIDS. And when Scientific American published an article by Dr. Peter Duisberg on his novel ideas about the trigger for cancer, they had to put in an editorial explaining that this didn't mean that they gave his AIDS views any credence. So mm-hmm. everybody's got to bow down to the god of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't bow down, you have to be punished.
Yes. I do understand. Mm-hmm.
That's how this system of science is not a group of free-thinking people. It is a hierarchical system run very much more like a military than it is like a group of people that sit around and come up with ideas and independently evaluate those ideas.
Well, you bring up the notion of being run by the military, and I have documented over the past how certain declarations of national AIDS emergency have taken place under executive order of the President of the United States, who is in the hierarchy of the military considered I can't remember the specific term, but he's ultimately the head of the entire U.S. military, commander-in-chief, and that as a consequence of making these declarations of a national AIDS emergency, we've actually seen the U.S. government dip into Department of Defense funds specifically to find money for African American related AIDS programming. Later, they were able to get federal funding to the tune of, I think, as much as $400 million per year. But in 1998, they actually went to the Department of Defense and secured $156 million worth of funding after Congresswoman Maxine Waters successfully convinced President Bill Clinton to declare a national AIDS emergency in the black community. What do you think about that process? Do you think that that process served the best self-interest of people of African descent in this country?
Well, used accidentally is the term self-interest. It certainly served the self-interest of a lot of people in the public health community. I mean, to them, bioterrorism is another source of funds. Right, you can draw upon military funds, and in America, my understanding is that out of everybody's tax dollars, about 60 cents now goes to the military. So for the public health service to keep growing like the cancer that it is, it has to find new sources of fund. So the double advantage of going to the military is, first of all, it's new money, and secondly, it helps build the fear. If you can define anthrax or AIDS or anything as a potential bioweapon or, you know, a threat to American security, then that helps pump up the fear in the community that, that this is something extraordinary. You know, if most Americans don't know that the majority of Americans getting diagnosed with AIDS aren't even sick at the time of diagnosis. They might be sick quickly after, because as soon as they're diagnosed, they're rushed onto the drugs.
Or they may be suffering from some other sort of immune challenge that has dumped a load of gamma globulin into their bloodstream.
Well, that's quite possible. It could be diet related. I mean, it's concerning that, you know, there's a huge amount of poverty in the black community, and that results in a poor diet, which is low in fresh fruits and vegetables and very high in overly processed foods that are deficient in vitamins and minerals. So there could be many people who are suffering from maybe too much food. There's also a lot of obesity, but it's the wrong kind of food. It's very high in highly processed carbohydrates and low in vitamins, minerals, and all the other things that the body really needs. There could be a lot of that. Plus, poor communities are more exposed to environmental toxins. They may be living in cities where all kinds of plants over the last 200 years have dumped toxic chemicals into the soil. They may be suffering the after effects of that as well. There's many causes. It's a lot easier to blame it on a mysterious virus, which is their problem.
And that the virus is only impacting on people who cannot control their sexual urges.
Exactly, yes. I mean, what a lovely system. It avoids going and starting to do soil analysis in those places and saying, you know, are these places contaminated with lead? Places that have been close to freeways for years. Well, you know, lead in gasoline wasn't banned. Shamefully, it wasn't banned until only, 20 years ago it was banned? So for most of the 1900s, roads were pumping lead to all the communities besides them. And, you know, who would want to go look at that?
Yeah, very serious points to make. We are talking this morning, Thursday, the 24th of April, with David Crowe. He's joining us on the telephone line. He is one of the primary movers and shakers in the whole movement to rethink AIDS, to question...
Yeah, well, one thing I'd just like to say is I was very proud on April the 1st to be appointed the president of Rethinking AIDS, which is an organization of scientists that has been around since the mid-1990s, the first scientists to get together as a group to question the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. And I hope that this organization will be heard from more and more in the future.
And what is your own personal background? What makes you qualified to be talking in this area of scientific endeavor?
Well, that's an excellent question. A lot of people consider scientist to be a job description. If you're paid to be a scientist, you must be one. But science is actually the application of the scientific method, which is really the application of open inquiry. I have a degree in biology and mathematics, and I also studied computer science, and that's been my employment for the last 20-so years. About 10 years ago, I set out to do a survey of the HIV/AIDS literature, and I have now read well over 1,000 peer-reviewed papers on HIV and AIDS, and well over 2,000 total documents, including government documents, corporate documents, newspaper articles, the whole gamut. And this has given me the confidence of scientists like Dr. Peter Duisberg, Dr. Etienne de Harvin, and the other members of the board of Rethinking AIDS, that I not only understand the science at an extremely high level, but that I have a background as an activist that I can get stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully this will bring the organization to a higher level of visibility and activity.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what Rethinking AIDS has done over the years. It's been a very fundamental part of my own evolution and growth in questioning and challenging this. I first began looking into the subject in 1987 while traveling as a professional musician. I first came across information that there had been this biological weapon of war that had been created to wipe out black people, and that this super virus had been invented in the laboratory and knew only to find the melanated gene. And at the time, it sounded credible to me. I had a laboratory background in reproductive biology. The only J-O-B I'd ever had in my life coming out of high school was working in a biological research lab in the then new field of artificial insemination. So I was fascinated by reproductive biology and biological science in general. My own father was an industrial chemist, and so I grew up in a household where science was elevated and greatly appreciated. He had his college textbook library in our home. But you know something? The closer I looked into this hypothesis that I had bought into, that this was a genetically engineered bioweapon, the more I saw these blazing contradictions between the people who were bringing this information and the literature that they were citing. They were citing that this literature contained the evidence of this, but when I went into research libraries from UCLA to Emory University to Johns Hopkins to get these very same documents and read them for myself, I said, wait, these contradictions are glaring, and cannot be ignored. Then I came across the dissenting crowd, which made a lot more sense. So by 1993, David, I reversed my position 180 degrees. And I then, from that point on, have never seen any evidence to make me reverse my position again. I no longer even believe in the existence of a distinct pathogen, the so-called AIDS virus.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting and ironic that just a couple of weeks ago, less than a month ago anyway, I debated Boyd Graves, who's one of the promoters of the ideas that HIV is a bioweapon created by the U.S. government. And after about 15 minutes of this debate, Boyd Graves just hung up the phone, which I guess I could say was an admission of defeat.
Do you have a recording? Do you have a copy of a recording of that interview?
Yes, that's on the web. I can send you the link to that. If you go to my website, aras.ab.ca.
Okay. Here, give me just a second to pull up another tab. I will put that immediately into a mess. A-R-A-S.
Alpha Romeo Alpha Sam .ab.ca.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go there, one of the top news items is the debate.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good. I appreciate that. I've been trying to get into a public presentation on a stage so where he can't hang up the phone with this man who calls himself Dr. Boyd Graves for
right.
some time. I consider him to be someone who's suffering somewhat from a psychosis. And is using this as his basically his claim for his human mission. I can appreciate all of us making a claim for a human mission, but for so many people to tell him for so long that his so-called evidence of this this discovery of that is actually flatulent. Excuse me, did I say flatulent? I meant fraudulent. And for him to still persist is makes him worthy of a castigation and condemnation.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I mean, my position is let's talk about the evidence for the existence, the purification of HIV. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at Gallo's early research, you see an electron micrograph that Gallo admitted 2 years later was not his. You know, so what does that mean? It must mean that Gallo didn't actually have any electron micrograph. And when you look at the electron micrograph, it's clearly not purified virus, because the virus particles are supposed to budding from a cell. But how do you tell it's a virus particle just by looking at it?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is you can't. You have to purify the virus. And if you purified the virus, you would have electron micrographs of pure virus.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that. And even an electron micrograph of pure virus is not enough. You still have to characterize that. You have to prove that the proteins that are from those pure particles and that the RNA that's from those pure particles match. They develop a genetic PCR test for HIV if you've never purified it, if that's not where you got the RNA from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, the debate with Boyd Graves is kind of interesting, and I think it indicates that, you know, he really doesn't have much except bluster. And he surrounds himself by a few people who believe in his theory, and consequently he rarely has to be faced with any real criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And when he is, he runs away.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately, I saw him a video of his PowerPoint presentation, and it's silly. It's so incredibly silly that I have to question. You know, Boyd Graves is a person of African ascent or descent. I would say descent in this case. And, you know, our audience largely, David, as you very well know, our audience is largely made up of people of African descent, even though there are progressives from a spectrum of other ethnicities who I know because I've been in contact with them who do listen consistently to us. But, you know, we make no bones about we serve a global black population. And so I have, you know, done the best I can to inform my constituency what I've heard and learned and read from people who are not of African descent. Christine Maggiore has been a wonderful influence in my own life.
Right.
Harvey Bialy is a dear friend, and we've covered interviews with Rebecca Coleshaw, with I could go on and on. Kim Bannon.
Yes.
And yourself, you've been on with us.
Right.
Liam Sheff, Dr. David Rasnick. We
right.
could go on. Dr. Charles Geschechter.
Right.
Christine Johnson. And a lot of people not of African descent have schooled me, and they've really respected and appreciated what I have brought to this dialogue. Well, now it's time for black people to catch up to steam and get up with what everybody else from the progressive movement challenging the HIV/AIDS pandemic. We're going to have to know what everyone else has known, that there is no test for HIV, that the HIV treatment protocols have been proven to cause the syndrome in an overwhelming majority of people who were not even sick when they got the damn diagnosis in the first place, and that this whole notion of Africa being overwhelmed and being Haiti and Uganda and these countries, populations being wiped out by HIV is complete and total fabrication and fantasy. It
yeah,
is
well,
not occurring.
Let me quote from the GlaxoSmithKline AZT product monograph. It was often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with administration of AZT from underlying signs of HIV disease or intercurrent illnesses. That's from the official label of the drug AZT.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we can cause the symptoms. And in America, like I mentioned earlier, since in 1997, 65% of new AIDS cases were in people that had no disease. They had a positive HIV test, and they had a low CD4 immune cell count, but no AIDS-defining illness, possibly no disease at all. And then they put them on drugs which can cause the symptoms of AIDS. And what do you think the doctors would tell you if you got sick after taking the AIDS drugs? Would they blame it on the drugs or the virus?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think we all know what happens.
Yeah. They blame it on everything but themselves.
Today in England, an article came out in the Independent, which is a major British newspaper, and they have done a survey of AIDS researchers, and those researchers basically say there will never be an HIV vaccine. says, a mood of deep pessimism has spread amongst the international community of AIDS scientists. Nearly two-thirds believed an HIV vaccine will not be developed within the next 10 years, and some of them said that it may take at least 20 more years. In 1984, on the first Rethinking AIDS Day, Robert Gallo said, 2 years, we'll have a vaccine. It's now been 24. They're now talking 34 or 44. Is it possible that there won't be a vaccine because there's no virus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They refuse to address that issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the great thing about failure in science,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot better to fail because then you have more opportunities for research funding. If they had succeeded in 2 years in solving the AIDS problem, if it really was viral, and if they'd come up with a vaccine in 2 years and they'd given it to everybody and that was the end of it, you know, this would have been a maybe $1 billion as opposed to a $1 trillion industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been a big failure for the AIDS scientists because they would have put themselves out of business. Well, there's no guarantee of putting there's no chance of putting themselves out of business when they're looking in the wrong place entirely.
We are live and direct again. It's Thursday the 24th. I'm just about to open up the telephone lines when we did have our first call. So anyone wishing to call and speak with David today, you can give us a call at 323-902-2919. You can call toll-free at 800-842-1409. In the UK, our London line, 0208-002-9096. You can Skype us at LIB Radio, and you can email info@libradio.net. Our first caller is on the line, David. Caller, welcome to the program. Your name and where are you calling from?
How you doing, Brother Key? This is Brother Ray from D.C.
Brother Ray from D.C., great to hear from you. Love what you're doing on the new website, livinginblack.com. You're very active and engaging. Thank you so much for being with us. David Crowe is our guest. What's on your mind today, Brother Ray?
I'd like to say hi to your guests also.
Hi, Ray.
How you doing?
I'm doing really good.
I'm a firefighter EMT in D.C., and we see the so-called AIDS patients, you know, on the regular. And it kind of hurts me to see these people this way when they really don't have to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the stuff that I've known since I started listening to you, Phil Valentine, and others on this subject, which has really been since last year, I'm thinking, you know, all along that AIDS is a real disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's real discouraging and heartbreaking, really. I'm also worried about the fact that people are really going on this fact that the bird flu is a real disease also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I see all these mass vaccinations and stuff that's starting up in the Asian countries. And you're starting to see, I mean, if you look on the internet, on Yahoo News, every day it's something new about bird flu. You know, they bring it up and keep bringing it up. And come to find out, the people that, one of the stockholders for Tamiflu was Donald Rumsfeld. Yeah. He made something like, I heard, like $15 million off his stock shares in Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm. So there's the overlapping oligarchical corporate cartels. And this great big daisy chain, and unfortunately the stuff that they're shooting is hitting the mass of the public in the eye, as crude
right.
metaphor, but...
I just think it's the vaccines and the drugs that they're taking that's killing these people. And it's
and it may also...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe also pesticides. I mean, in a lot of the places where bird flu occurs, pesticides are used, you know, without much knowledge on the part of the people who are using them.
Mm-hmm.
And that can cause very serious symptoms.
Mm,
now, what do you think about the chemtrails? Do you think that has a part to play into it?
I don't have any knowledge of that. It's not something I've ever researched.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were an EMT?
Right, firefighter
yeah.
EMT.
Well, what's really fascinating is the number of EMTs who have had documented transmission of HIV or AIDS in America since the beginning of the epidemic, because after all, you're often exposed to dangerous situations. I presume that if you come across a car accident and you're extracting somebody from the car, you don't stop to do an HIV test first, right?
No, we don't.
No. Well, the total number of emergency medical technicians and paramedics who've had documented transmission of HIV and AIDS is, drumroll please, Katie,
Pow, pow, pew!
Zero. That's a big goose egg, and not an avian flu goose egg. There's not a single case of transmission to a paramedic, and you know how many have occurred in surgeons? The same big zero. Now, how can a blood-transmitted virus not affect surgeons and paramedics?
Well, they try to. The thing I heard is they try to say once it leaves, it touches the air, the AIDS virus lasts less than a second.
And, these are the same people that a few years ago said it lived for 9 days in the air.
Right. And how did drug addicts get it from exchanging needles? Because, I mean, a needle's in the air for a few seconds.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
You know,
so
and why, you know, there was a case in California where a boy pricked himself on a needle, and Planned Parenthood called in child services when the mother didn't want to give the boy AZT. Well, the needle had been sitting on the ground. Nobody knew if it had been exposed to somebody who was HIV positive at all. And who knows how long it had been on the ground? Certainly more than 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, they were going to panic on that. I mean, there's a lot of inconsistencies in this. They'll say one thing if you challenge them on one topic, and then they'll say totally the opposite if you challenge them on something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
Brother Ray, we're going to get a final comment or question as we have a very limited time with our live programming today. We love hearing from you, and definitely your experience as an EMT gives a great amount of credibility to why we're having this program today, and I appreciate you for that.
I appreciate it, too. And another, just one thing I wanted to, I want to get the man's website. If you could put it up on your website, Keedy, or send me an
email. We will cross-link that. I just did forward that to you in your email. And, yeah, I will cross-link that in the hot link section of LIB or radio.
Okay. The thing we were doing is if we supposedly had gotten exposure, we would have to take this cocktail.
Right.
And that the cocktail would get you so sick that some of the people would have to be off of work for, you know, a couple of weeks.
Well, there was one drug in that cocktail they gave to people who'd supposedly been exposed to HIV, a drug called nevirapine, that they had to stop using because it was causing liver failure in people who had only taken the drug for a couple of weeks.
Mm.
I mean, that's not just like being off work. I mean, these drugs can actually kill you short-term use.
Mm-hmm. This is insane. Okay.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ray.
We really appreciate you calling in today, Ray. And keep on doing all the great things you're doing. Great to be having you on this team, my brother.
All right. Thank you, bro.
Respect.
Peace.
All right. Telephone lines are open again. Telephone numbers are, in case you want to get through, speak with our guest this morning. His name is David Crow from the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society and now president of the Rethinking AIDS Organization. Telephone numbers are 323-902-2919. You can call toll-free 800-842-1409. You can call it 0208-002-9096 in London. Email info@libradio.net. And if there's someone out who vehemently disagrees, who thinks that Dave and I have been smoking or dropping psilocybin mushrooms or some other trippy stuff, sniffing gasoline, and you disagree, come on, be bold, be deliberate, stand up, argue your point. We will gladly listen to you. And if we think you are accurate, he and I will go into the research laboratories and confirm it. But if we think that you're inaccurate, we'll explain to you carefully how we came to a different understanding. It's all about growth. It's all about transformation. It's all about having the right information that can help us move our lives together. David, we've conducted here at LIB Radio over 100, probably close to 120 hours worth of interviews, documentary film soundtracks, et cetera, et cetera. I think that we may have the biggest collection of original interviews on this subject of any radio station that I know of. And I've firmly concluded that you and the others that we've shared on this perspective are absolutely correct, that this thing can be trash. It can be thrown out of our lexicon if the people would just come forward with the proper knowledge and information and understanding of that information.
Yeah, I remember when I first read Dr. Peter Duisberg's book, his 1996 book, Inventing the AIDS Virus.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, I was just stunned. It was, to me, I love detective fiction. You know, it's one of my weaknesses. And I felt that this was like a detective novel, except instead of just a few clues, you know, the clues to the fact that these guys were going down the wrong track were so numerous that it was going to be impossible for the mainstream to say he's wrong on every point. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they could say he was wrong on a few points, but all Duisberg had to be was right on one of his major points, and the theory falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, nobody has ever really come back against Duisberg. The best that the establishment has is an anonymous webpage on the NIH website. And it's anonymous, it's not peer-reviewed, it's impossible to respond to it. It changes at different times, it just gets updated without any notification. You know, if something becomes too embarrassing on that site, it just gets changed. That's the best that the scientific establishment has.
Mm.
Where's the peer-reviewed response to Duisberg's argument?
Yeah.
There just isn't anything.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of one-page drive-by shootings is about the best that the establishment has been able to put together.
Mm-hmm.
One of my biggest concerns these days is the legal aspects of being HIV positive. I don't know if you heard, but in Canada, a man named Carl Leone was sentenced to 18 years in jail for having sex while being HIV positive. I believe it's similar in the U.S., but what happens is if you have consensual sex while you're HIV positive in Canada and you don't reveal your status, that's considered aggravated sexual assault, which is normally aggravated sexual assault would be rape with a weapon. A woman who's raped and beaten. But in this case, it's consensual sex without any violence at all. And if the person dies, if the person is HIV positive, takes drugs, and dies of the side effects of the drugs, it's automatic first-degree murder. Normally, first-degree murder requires intent. But there's a special exemption in Canada that in the case of aggravated sexual assault that results in the death of a woman, it's first-degree murder.
Mm.
And so there's a first-degree murder case in Canada with a man named Johnson Aziga. He believes he's Ugandan, but he's lived in Canada for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, Canada doesn't have the death penalty, but in the U.S. it's possible that this extraordinary legal overreaching could result in the execution of somebody for having consensual sex with somebody who, with a woman or a man who later takes AIDS drugs, dies of a side effect, and is blamed on the HIV positive person.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is the most worrying trend. Basically, the sexuality of every HIV positive person has been criminalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and criminalized based upon an antibody testing process that is fundamentally flawed. Now, wouldn't it be possible then to go into court to challenging the how was it determined that the perpetrator or that the victim were determined to be HIV antibody reactive, and to recognize that without the gold standard in a diagnostic method, that no one can really tell who is what is?
Well, let me tell you my experience in this case of Carl Leone. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, I flew to Windsor, Canada, where Carl Leone and his family was. I spent a week with the defense lawyer. I went through the documents that he had, the documents I had. I wrote up a detailed critique of the evidence of the prosecution witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
I pointed out that in Ontario and many other places, people who are considered at risk get HIV tested in a different way, which might result in a greater possibility of them being HIV positive. I deconstructed a report that said that this man had the same virus as his alleged victims. And I think I completely freaked out the defense lawyer. He was very interested. He thought, obviously, he thought that these were serious allegations that were based on science.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, the client pled guilty. Now, I don't think that was a coincidence. What happened was the lawyer must have decided, if I go into court with an argument that is against the entire medical establishment, I'm going to make a fool of myself. I'm not going to let this happen. I'm not going to bring this forward. So I'm going to suggest that this man plead guilty. And the consequence of pleading guilty to avoid having the women testify against him was that he got 18 years. In fact, he really got 21 years because he was
he had 3 years time served before his sentencing.
Wow.
In Canada, 25 years is a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, he got a life sentence, and he never harmed anybody. He never touched a woman in anger, and he never forced anybody to have sex. And yet, he's getting a life sentence. Most murderers in Canada might get 2, 3, 4, 5 years, depending on brutality of the crime.
Mm-hmm. Yes, unbelievable that this process has degenerated to what it is, but it is what it is, and the world is stuck with this untenable, unholy alliance between white-collar criminals who have woven themselves in the medical, pharmaceutical, and legal process.
Yes, and I also learned a lesson in how the censorship works, because, you know, I had tried to communicate with some of the local media without much success, but the CBC, which is the Canadian public broadcaster,
mm-hmm.
contacted me and, you know, early 1 week, and they said, okay, on Friday, we want to have an interview with you. You know, typical morning radio can be 6 minutes long. You know, it gives you lots of time to go into all the details of this issue. But that's fine. So on Friday, an hour before the interview, they phone up and say, well, we've decided that, you know, we can't really do this. We're going to need a medical reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody will get back to you. And, of course, they never did. So presumably the CBC headquarters said, we are not going to touch the story. So the media has decided that a defender of this man, who's one of the most hated men in Canada right now, a defender of that man is not allowed to be heard on the radio. Too dangerous for Canadians to be exposed to contrary information. We have to protect them from this, so we're just going to censor the story.
Mm. And censored stories seem to abound in this field of challenging the legitimacy of the AIDS establishment. But nonetheless, David, yourself, myself, and no small number of others have gained, we've gained a significant amount of momentum in bringing our challenge. I think the greatest part right now is just getting word out on the quality of our challenge that we have done. Can you point to some of the bright areas that you think we're making progress on this?
Well, every person who contacts me and who contacts many of the other rethinkers who then makes a personal decision to stop the drugs based on the evidence that we've been able to supply to them, or decides not to get tested, or decides that their lover who is HIV positive is not going to kill them. Every one of those people, and there's been many in my experience, and I know, you know, thousands of others have contacted other people like Dr. Peter Duesberg, Christine Maggiore, Kim Bannon. Every one of those is a victory. And this is how we're going to win this, is one person at a time. Every person, like Ray in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
who thinks about it, opens their mind, and looks at some of the evidence and says, you know, I've swallowed a croc for 10, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to take it anymore. I think every one of those is a victory. An appearance on independent media, like yourself,
mm-hmm.
like this interview I did with Boyd Graves, which is on a Toronto radio station, there's many openings within the independent media where we can get our story out, and those are also victories.
Yes, sir.
The fact that we had an organized celebration of Rethinking AIDS Day for the first time this year, and hopefully on the 25th anniversary of this horrible date, 1 year from yesterday, we will have an even bigger remembering, and we will remember all the people who've died, all the people who've lived in fear, all the people who've been jailed, all the parents who've been separated from their children. That's what we'll be remembering. It's not a day that we want to remember. It's a day we wish we could forget, but we won't forget until it's over.
Mm-hmm. Until it's over, do you think somehow, some way, the broad medical establishment in this country is just going to one day capitulate and say, all right. y'all didn't really take us seriously.
No, they won't. I read a really good book about the anti-slavery movement, which took it from the perspective of a group of activists And they, the author made a very good point that at the beginning of the anti-slavery movement, about 50 years before slavery was abolished, nobody gave them any hope. Mm. You're a bunch of nobodies. You know, you're not important people. You have no money. You know, you're wasting your time. Sure, you know, we should abolish slavery, but it's just not going to happen. 50 years later, slavery was abolished within the British Empire, and that was the beginning of the end, although I know slavery still exists in the world in some forms today.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the beginning of the end, and it was a few activists that nobody gave any credence to who stopped it. So I think the same thing can happen with this. The HIV-positive people who've been affected by this need to keep with the movement. They can't say, okay, I've been released from this, so I'm going to go away now.
Mm-hmm.
They need to commit to the movement in time, in money, in communicating with other people. Scientists who believe have to get up the courage to say what they believe to their fellow scientists, no mm-hmm. matter what the consequences. There's far too much cowardice in this society, and often it's unnecessary. You know, often the consequences of speaking up aren't nearly as great as you might think. But people can be cowed by this fear. Well, what will happen if I tell somebody at work that I don't believe in the HIV hypothesis?
Mm-hmm.
Chances are those people will be fascinated and interested and might want to do their own research.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to have the courage to talk to their family, to talk to their friends, to talk to people around the coffee machine at work. You know, just say, you know, maybe the reason there's no vaccine is because there's no virus.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the reason why the drugs aren't curing anybody is because the drugs are for a virus that doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's not the cause of AIDS.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've got a few more minutes with our guests, and we're going to have to cut out early today, but we highly encourage our listening audience to be a part of this conversation. You do want a piece of this. And I want you to go to David's websites and do your own research. Do your own challenge right there. I think it's a great website full of wonderful information. David, can you share, once again, your web information with those who may be just joining the broadcast this morning?
Well, two websites, really. I'm the president of Rethinking AIDS, which is rethinkingaids.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for many years, I've been the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS Society, which is aras.ab.ca.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I've been using both of those websites for quite some time. I find them to be incredibly, wonderfully useful, and I'm definitely going to encourage people to participate in those to the best of our abilities. We have the ability now to bring a whole new paradigm to our overstanding of what is happening here, and it's empowering, it's liberating. But
right.
if people don't want to engage in reading sometimes complex documents, if they don't want to engage in asking fundamental questions relative to science, then they're just going to kind of go along with the flow. And when we're talking about just $400 million within the American budget for African-American AIDS, guess who's going along with the flow, David?
Yes.
Guess who's going along with the flow? Guess who's caught up in the paradigm? Guess who are the first ones to be drug out? Ooh, I'm about to start cussing and raging. The first ones to be drug out on World AIDS Day. Who do they paint the picture of World AIDS Day as? Black people. And on African-American AIDS Day. Now, African-Americans have their own AIDS Day to go in this country. There's so much money. There are so many full-time paid advocates in all the major cities helping to launder that $400 million annually in blood money, and I mean that literally. That's
yeah.
blood money.
Yeah, it's like when the government comes throwing money at you, you might want to be suspicious. You might want to think about that.
This is the same government that won't even allow the word reparations for the centuries of abuse and horrible abuse by the United States government, and it tolerate toleration of abuse by private citizens and corporations and businesses in this country. The same government that refuses to even think of the word reparations wants to repair us when it comes to that HIV in our blood. Hey, David, I don't believe
it. Based on you. You see, with the what they did with the gay community is the gay community had to either admit that they were sexually irresponsible or that they had a drug problem. And they decided that they would go with the sex. And so they had to blame their sexuality for the illnesses that a very small percentage of them were experiencing. And they're trying to do the same with the black community.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you're sick, it's your fault. And, you know, we're where you have to go for a solution, and there's drugs, and you're not going to like them, but that's what you got to do. Now, if you want to believe that, that's fine. The consequences are criminalization of your sexuality, drugs that are going to end up killing you, terrorization. I mean, they've done the same thing with cancer to some extent, although not as targeted.
Mm-hmm.
But they say with cancer, they love to tell you it's your fault. You don't eat enough fruit and vegetables. You this, that, and the other thing. But they don't ever say, well, it's because you're living downstream from a refinery or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never say that because that's not good for business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very true. David, we are nearing the end of the program. We do have a couple of more minutes. Any good, any more information? You just got to get into the record today.
I think Rethinking AIDS, you can go to a new video that, you know, if people aren't into reading a bunch of text, there's a new video on the web that was created in commemoration of Rethinking AIDS Day, and that's definitely worth looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, explore the sites and contact me if you have questions. And if I can't answer the question, there's a lot of experts out there that I can put you in touch with if you have specific questions that I don't have information on.
I'm just always appreciative, David, of the work that you're doing. I always appreciate getting emails from you because they're full of information, positive information that you and I and others are using to turn back this evil, ugly, oligarchical empire called the medical pharmaceutical drug complex and their allies in the corporate-controlled media and those punk-ass bitches. Excuse me, I'm sorry my language so bad. Those elected officials who, without questioning, support and embrace these anti-fertility campaigns. I almost called them punk-ass bitches on the air.
And
can you believe
don't
that?
Let you escape without thanking you for being such a good friend of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
All we ask is that the information gets out there. We don't ask that we have the ability to ram it down people's throats. We don't ask for people to believe. We just ask for people to have access to the information, and you're helping make that happen, Katie, and I can't thank you enough for that.
Yeah, I'm enjoying this. I actually like calling politicians punk-ass bitches on the air.
you can call politicians whatever you want, Katie, and you're not going to get any objection from me.
Yeah, and Robert Gallo, I'm not going to call him a punk-ass bitch. I'm just going to say that, you know, the devil's got to have some top lieutenants somewhere.
Well, he's somewhat getting, you know, he apparently is quite worried about his legacy. Apparently his grandchildren have heard that he might be a crook, and that worries him. Well, you know, it's like the grandchildren of the people who worked at Enron in the executive suite. You know, their grandchildren are gonna hear that grandpa's a crook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, damn it, that's what happens when you are a crook.
That's what happens when you are a thief, when you are a criminal, when you are a crook, when you are a theft of thousands of people's lives.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what often brings me back down to earth, is the knowledge that not just thousands, but probably hundreds of thousands of people have been killed by this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, you know, it's hard to conceive of that large of a number, but the relatively small number of people that I've known personally who have been killed by the HIV/AIDS paradigm is you know, admittedly much more powerful to me. When you see somebody that you love and care for destroyed by the system, not
by HIV, but destroyed by the drugs, destroyed by the society that rejects them or tries to coerce them into doing things they don't want to, or the suicides of people who've just given up hope that they're ever going to be able to live a normal life. I mean, that really gets at me and keeps me focused on ending the nightmare.
All right. David, I thank you once again for being with us. Once again, as we close out, for people who want to maintain contact with you, do you have an email address, websites you will share with them?
Well, rethinkingaids.com is a good website to go to, and my email address, david.crow@aras.ab.ca.
All right, and we've done a good job. Those who didn't hear this whole conversation can go into our catalog. Really, right now, we've just put this one up so that you will be able to get this information from our guest today. David Crow is his name. Just look for him in the hot links section of LIB Radio. It's got an email link to you, David, as well as the links to the Alberta Repraising AIDS Society, as well as Rethinking AIDS. You're doing a great job.
Great.
Anytime you want to get the word out, you know, you just drop an email to me, say, Kitty, we got somebody hot. Anybody, if you can get me on to some of the top people. You know, we've interviewed so many people, I've never been able to get a hold of Dr. Peter Duesberg. I've met him one time, but I've had him on LIB Radio, and I've had everybody else but him. And so next time you talk to Peter Duesberg, say, man, if you don't get an interview with Kitty on LIB Radio, man, he's going to bring the hammer.
Yeah,
he's going to bring some heat down on you.
Yeah, I will definitely keep that in mind. He's probably busy right now with the end of term at school, but I think in a few weeks he'll have a bit more time on his hand. I should tell him as soon as he's got some free time, he should drop you a line.
Yeah, it'll be great. It'll be great having him on with us. And I think that, you know, we'll be able to get through that thick German accent of his on the radio.
It's not that thick. I've dealt with a lot worse. You just have to tell him to make sure he speaks English. I was visiting him once, and he started speaking German to me 90 miles an hour. wait.
Yeah, well, I can always just translate for him if that needs to be.
Yes.
All right, David,
okay.
Doing a great job. We'll be talking to you again.
Okay, thanks, Katie.
Great
lovely
to see
to be
you,
on your show.
And I'm going to email you the link. You're going to have this file coming at you in just about 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
So feel free to do with it what you will. Of course, I know you're probably going to want to post it up on your website.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Katie.
Greetings to you, David.
Okay.
And we are wrapping up our program today. I've got to get out of here and head on down into the city to each and every one of you. I'm so wonderfully grateful to have you with us. I'm so grateful to all of you who tuned in today on LIB-TV. We had a wonderful size audience. And I found another piece of audio. I'm going to push it right up right now. This is the debate David Crow was talking about that he had with the man who calls himself Dr. Boyd Graves, the one who says he has the absolute evidence of AIDS being created in the laboratory. He says, I have that absolute evidence. I say he's showing a bunch of papers that were from the failed oncovirus research program, and he calls them the U.S. Special Virus Research Program, a terminology that he made up. Boy, what people won't do so they can get out on stage and dance and say, look, Mom, I finally made it to Broadway. I'm a big star now, Mommy. Oh, boy. Do stay tuned. I'm going to be getting out of here, but LIB Radio is going to be going every day, all day long. If you miss any portion of this interview, just tune in a few hours. It's going to repeat. And also, last night I had an incredible conversation on Future Talk and Tech Talk, talking about the global crises. 5 of the world's major food crops are in explosive price increases. This food war thing, this food emergency thing we've been talking about is getting more and more real by the day. As you probably heard the news stories from yesterday, people are now raiding the big box stores and buying 50-pound sacks of rice. Where is it going to lead to? Tune in. Future Talk. Tech Talk is going to be coming up in just a few minutes. You're not going to hear it on LIB TV or Living in Black. You got to go to libradio.com and click in to listen to our archives 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Tell your friends to tell their friends. And if you are of African descent, we invite you to join with us at livinginblack.com. as we now build with self, by self, for self, to do a whole new different future paradigm. Peace, y'all. LIB Radio, living in black, loving it like that. We'll talk to you soon.